Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Columbia River Gorge is a land of mountains, high desert plateaus, rivers, canyons, oak savannas, lush valleys, and an amazing diversity of plant and animal life. And there's a lot going on in the Columbia Gorge, including some of the most significant environmental campaigns in the region that get often overlooked by media in Portland. Into this void is bounded Columbia Insight, a nonprofit publication and regional news source for communities throughout the Columbia River Basin. Their mission is to inspire, educate, and foster a sense of community around environmental issues affecting the basin by publishing original, fair, and balanced journalism that tells the untold stories of the region. Today we get to meet some of the folks behind this endeavor. We'll talk with Columbia Insight's publisher Susan Hess and managing editor Dak Collins about what their publication has been focusing on, and we'll get deeper into some of the areas of special interest these days, like the plight of the Columbia River salmon that swim past their office in Hood River. Susan and Dak, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. Well, tell me, what is the need to have your own voice out in Hood River and throughout the gorge? Why is it that you feel like you need to be explaining things that aren't maybe getting explained in the larger media centers in the region?
Well, I think like a lot of news media throughout the country, you know, as newspapers have been shrinking, that sort of general voice that was, you know, widely available, reasonably inexpensive, that, you know, sort of the wide population could get. So it's, you know, the news has been kind of squeezed everywhere, but particularly in the environment. And so it's great to be able to have that voice to talk about the sort of interconnectedness of the things that are affect us. You know, I think that example in Flint, Michigan, you know, if it hadn't been for the press bringing that up, that critical environmental issue, you know, that would have gone on for decades more to catastrophe.
And does Hood River have its own newspaper?
It does.
And is it a reliable news source?
It is, but, you know, they're conscripted too. You know, they have very small staff, and but you know, so there's very little environmental coverage, but you know, I think that they provide a great service to the community with providing events around and a voice where people can talk about, you know, the Letters to the Editor is a very popular section.
I understand it isn't. Actually, I was told, even in the Oregonian many years ago, that's the most highly read section of any newspaper's Letters to the Editor.
Definitely.
So let's talk about some of the issues in Hood River and in the gorge. Well, first of all, before we get to that, I just wanted to, I took this line sort of from your bio, Susan, about the diversity of the gorge. And it's one of these things that as I have gotten to know it better and better over many years, have begun to, at first I appreciated that there was like a huge amount of diversity. Then I started to understand why. So let's first of all talk about what is it that makes the gorge such a diverse area, such a diverse region, and how does that affect the kinds of life forms that we see there, and how that is, do those life forms affect the people who live there?
Well, I'll start off and let Dak come right in. It's, you know, it's the only sea level highway, in highway, and but I mean in many senses of the word, air, water, through the, you know, through the Cascades, for hundreds of miles in either direction. So that makes it really unique that you've got in 80 miles from, let's say, the Sandy River to the Deschutes, you go from 100 inches of rain, say, around the Cascade Locks and the sort of midpoint of the Cascades to about 11 or 10 inches in the Dalles. It creates, you know, a huge amount of microclimates.
Yeah, I think it's the diversity and just such a short range, the amount of ecosystems that you can travel through just driving down 84, you know, when you get past kind of what we think of as the heart of the gorge and Cascade Locks and Hood River, and how quickly you get into that dry desert ecosystem, and you go from having, you know, these beautiful lush fern-lined creeks to very dry arid regions that you just have one major river coursing through it. So I think each one of those has its own, you know, unique set of challenges, and everybody there is you know, they've kind of have their own, their head in their own little space, but we can also learn from all these different places and how we can best care for these places. But I think that the big thing is that we have the Columbia coming through it. You know, it's all this huge, interconnected, massive ecosystem that is all linked by this huge river that comes, like you say, right past our office in the river. So,
well, another thing that I kind of learned from biologists and stuff that I've talked to over the years is it's not just the horizontal, the x-axis of the gorge that is very diverse. It's also the y-axis, the vertical. And that comes from the fact that, 20,000 years ago, the Columbia River flowed through a very wide floodplain. Mm. And it was... And all these waterfalls in the gorge were once rivers that flowed directly into the Columbia. And then with the Missoula floods, it started about 18,000 years ago, and it carved this sharp channel that became the Columbia Gorge. So there's these places like that were left, I mean, that they used to be connected on the same vertical plane as the river, but they're not anymore. And so I know, and I've read wildflower books in particular, that the amazing amount of wildflowers you find different kinds of life forms that would exist at different altitudes. So it's kind of like taking Mount Hood and making it, squishing it into a much faster transition line.
Yeah.
So, and actually in Hood River, I mean, you sort of explore, because you're basically also at the gateway to Mount Hood. So I want to just describe a little bit about what the land is like around Hood River, because you start out with all this farmland, and then before you know it, you're in the alpine area. So what is it like there, and how does the people in Hood River and environs connect to each other and through these different landscapes?
Barbara, if I may, I'm going to broaden that up just a little bit. I'll come back to that. But, you know, we chose the name Columbia Insight because of the interconnectedness of it. So while that's our base, we certainly, you know, look at the much broader basin as such. But so to get back to the sort of Hood River white salmon, you've got this wonderful Columbia River in the middle of it, which of course, as we all know, is now a pond, a river, you know, it's a lake now, not a river so much, but still that basic river is there. And then coming into it on one side, you've got the White Salmon River coming on the Washington side, and then you've got the Hood River coming down. So Hood River is a very narrow valley. You know, we were talking about the different microclimates. From one side of the Hood River Valley, from the west side to the east side, there's a difference of 6 inches of rainfall in that thing. So you're going ground level. So I think we're at 500, maybe 500 feet at Hood River, and then you're going up very quickly up to the top of Mount Hood, which is 11,000 some odd feet.
And it's only like about 40 miles, I think, from Hood
River. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then you've got a lot of orchards, primarily winter pear orchards, that until the forest starts up there. And in fact, we've been told that it's one of the few places that there's still family-owned orchards, you know, that so much of farming has become industrialized that Hood River is sort of unique in having these family-owned.
And white salmon as well has a lot of orchards.
Yes, too. Exactly. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, so you've got Mount Adams on one side, and look in your mirror, and you've got Mount Hood.
In fact, it's really fun to be hiking on Mount Adams and looking back at Mount Hood. I mean, one of the most interesting times I ever had was I was hiking on Mount Adams over to Bird Creek Meadow and got a great glimpse of the beginnings of the Dollar Lake Fire.
Oh.
And at the beginning in the morning, or late morning, early afternoon, we started the hike. There was just a little wisp of smoke. When we came back in the evening, it was full-blown fire. Not exactly the thing that you really want to be seeing from one mountain to another, but it was interesting to have that kind of mirror relationship between the two mountains. How does that reflect on Hood River, too? Because you've got much more of a relationship with the mountains out in Hood River than you do here in Portland.
Do you think so? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Hood River, I mean, Mount Hood is kind of, you know, there in the distance, off in the east from Portland. And I know when I go to Hood River, I mean, it becomes in your back rearview mirror after a little while, but it's there looming, I think, a lot more. And it also seems like, to me, it seems that there's more of an interconnectedness between the lives of people out in the central part of the gorge and the landscape around them.
Certainly. I think it's a big part of the culture and why a lot of people move there. I've been living in the gorge, been lucky enough to live there for the past 2 years. But if you look at the history of how, I mean, Susan could probably tell better about how the shift when, you know, just thinking about one sport, kiteboarding and windsurfing, the way that town changed when recreation was, you know, became such a big focus. So yeah, it's from, you know, anybody who's into outdoor sports and just having some public land and wilderness nearby, it's a wonderland. So I think people do live there in a big part because of the mountains, because of that presence, because of the ability to, you know, get really close to those places and get to know those places. So yeah, I think Mount Hood's really, really special.
Well, I want to throw out a little bit of politics. Also, you're in Greg Walden's district, right?
Yes.
We are.
In fact, doesn't he live in Hood River?
He does, just on the street from us. Yeah, actually.
I understood that they're talking about possibly splitting the 5th district, and it won't be the 5th district, that he's in the 2nd, I guess, but splitting it into, I guess, into a 6th district, that he was going to think about moving out of Hood River because he wouldn't get elected from the Hood River district. But there's a change in politics, and back when you're talking about the windsurfing, kite surfing stuff. I mean, I remember Hood River, actually, I remember it from the early 70s, and I loved it back then too, but it was a farm town, totally a farm town. It had the best Mexican food in Oregon, actually. The only good Mexican restaurant in Oregon was in Hood River back then.
Really?
And because it always had, I mean, it had already a Mexican population that was working as farm workers, but who's, I think, become a much more integrated part of the community since then. But the politics of Hood River has definitely moved towards the liberal end, I think, a lot in the last 40 years. And I'm wondering how that is reflected now. I mean, well, you can't compare it, but maybe Susan, you have a little bit more background about what it used to be like in the days before windsurfing.
Politically.
Yeah, politically.
Yeah, I think that's been a shock to almost everyone. You know, I think the rural areas throughout the world tend to be, as a whole, more conservative. You know, that's a generation, I mean, a generality, but I think it was also timber. You know, I think when we moved there, there were 7 sawmills at that time, just in the Hood River Valley. I mean, in addition to all the ones in White Salmon and up in, you know, Stevenson and to Klickitat. So those are, you know, there's one now, and it's really based in Carson, Washington, really, than in Hood River. So that's been, all that has been a big change. And I think this recreation community that came in with the scenic area did probably play a part in changing that, the politics. And also then, you know, in situ coming in. And so with that, you had all these tech companies that have come in around it. So, you know, maybe that's all played a part, you know.
Well, it was Oregon, the Northwest, up until not that long ago, was basically resource extraction land.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was sort of sad side, I think, of the Northwest culture. While there was this great in the woods feeling of connectedness with nature, there was also this big equation of big tree equals lots of money, and there was a lot of really bad practices. It seems to me that, I mean, Hood River, particularly, I'm thinking about the Nestle bottling water campaign,
right.
Which was in Hood River County, which is your county. The bottling plant was going to be in Cascade Locks, who the town wanted it. Hood River didn't want it. It seems like there's more of you than there were Cascade Locks, and so you voided it out of existence. But to me, I saw that was an example of a real sense of, it's a certain kind of civic pride that really understands what your natural resources are worth. And I think it goes deeper than just windsurfing.
Definitely, definitely.
And I wanted to give, there were people in Cascade Locks who were very much opposed to it as well. And so I want to, you know, recognize those folks who worked really hard to feel like that was a threat to the community as well.
And you want to say something, Dak?
I think, you know, as we move into the future and people from, whether you're living in the Southwest or California, realize the importance of water, I think we're, whether we're newcomers to the Hood River Valley or the Gorge or just moved there, we're increasingly realizing how important and good we have it with Mount Hood being there as a water source and, you know, the springs on the White Salmon side. The hydrology there is spectacular. So I think that we're even more so realizing what we have to protect in that region.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Susan Hess and Dak Collins, who are publisher and managing editor of the online journal Columbia Insight. Let's talk a bit more about this magazine. I was looking at it a few times this week just to kind of check in on what you're up to. And I see that you have different themes that you do. How many articles come out each month?
Generally, right now, we're publishing between 3 and 5 articles a month. Usually, every couple of weeks, we're coming out with some stories. The big idea, I don't want to talk too much about the roots of it because we have to give credit to Susan here. A lot of this was her vision. But, you know, what we're really thinking about now is how to bring in, you know, not just writers, but bring in the perspectives from the whole basin. So we've got a writer in Eugene now. We've got a new contributing writer who lives in the Spokane area, and we've got some Gorge locals. So, Yeah, we're trying to look at the whole basin and looking at ways that we can bring attention to issues that, you know, even way up in Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, places that don't have the, I guess you could say, the environmental mindset that a lot of people in Portland have. You know, they don't have that much access to this sort of information. So we're seeing ourselves as sort of filling that void and coming into these places and trying to really serve those communities in the best way we can and giving them this information because.
Well, you talk about the Columbia Basin, so some people might not quite understand what that means. They're going to say, go like, Eugene, that's part of the Columbia Basin or Spokane. So let's talk about what is the Columbia Basin.
I'll start off. Well, first of all, it's the size of France. And so it goes from the mouth of Astoria, and then it goes to as far as the Tetons, you know, in Wyoming, and of course up into Canada, where is the origin of it. But the Willamette River is a tributary, the Yakima River is a tributary, the Snake River is a tributary. It goes on and on. It's a huge. I did calculate it out one time. It is actually the size of France.
So actually, the source of the Columbia River is actually a golf course in sort of southeastern British Columbia, which is kind of
there.
It's interesting because the first time I ever came out west and I was crossing the Trans-Canadian Highway, and we went stopped at the Continental Divide, and I think it's called Yolo Creek, which I guess means in the indigenous language, wow. It's this beautiful. It was this incredible waterfall, and it was really beautiful. Because that's what you like to think is the source of the Columbia River, but no, it's actually about 30 miles south, and it's this golf course.
Wow,
which is kind of a funny thing. And I think that to me is a metaphor for some of the challenges that the Columbia River and the whole basin has experienced. You talk about it going into the Teton. So, what is that source? Because we know the Columbia doesn't flow to Wyoming. So, what river is that feeds into the Columbia?
That would be the headwaters of the Snake. You know, the winds and the Green River, all those come together and kind of venture down southwest and then cut up north, and the Snake, you know, joins the Columbia around the, you know, where Oregon and Washington, Idaho all meet right there. Most of Idaho is actually in the basin too, and that's a region that we're really interested in, but, you know, at this point, seeing how we can, you know, kind of slowly spread our coverage out to this such a vast region and still be able to, as you know, get a grasp of what all is going on. You know, there's so much to...
Well, there's so much diversity in that. I mean, and then we start, besides having all this geographic and social and geologic diversity, there's also a lot of political diversity.
Definitely.
Talking about Idaho right next
Definitely.
To Oregon.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just thinking about people talking about, you know, being able to travel across country with an electric car and the charging stations ended Ontario, Oregon. I don't think there's any in Idaho.
Oh, really?
I'm not sure about that, but it's probably some in Boise, but it's not, it's definitely a difference there. So how would you incorporate the kind of conservatism that Idaho has become known for, which it didn't used to be like that many in the years of Frank Church and other people like that, but it's certainly become a hotbed of very right-wing conservatism. How do you incorporate that with the more progressive views that your magazine actually seems to reflect?
Well, I mean, hopefully that's what good journalism is, you know, is that you give everybody a voice and we trust our readers, our listeners to, to make good opinions out of that. I mean, we always say, you know, we are definitely pro-environment because we all need it. You know, all the creatures, all the plants need that. But we try to give everybody a voice that, you know, they'll be treated fairly. You know, we'd like to interview them and we'd like to get through, and like I say, trust the readers to make good decisions out of that.
So let's think about some of the really hot button issues and sort of see how you bring that in. So we've all just recently seen this very fine film called Damned to Extinction, which links the impending demise of the southern resident orcas in the Salish Sea, in Puget Sound and Georgia Strait in that area, with the impending demise of the Chinook salmon that particularly swim up the Snake River from the Columbia River and have to pass through four kind of bogus dams that basically consider them window dressing dams. So that's very contentious, and people in Idaho want those dams. People in eastern Washington to some degree want those dams. People who care about salmon want to take them out. So I'm wondering how you bring that story together.
Yeah, that's dealing with salmon. Yeah, that's something that really is something I think a lot about. And even when we're looking at this issue, and even people who want to see Salmon coming back, there's splits in the factions there, you know. I'm just thinking about, for example, you know, the dams are a big issue, but there's also a lot of attention right now being given to the issue of hatchery fish and wild fish. And so we have these groups of people who, you know, we all want to see fish coming back, but for what reason? Is it so that we can catch them and eat them? Is it because we really want to see, you know, this species that was here using these rivers way longer than we are actually coming back up and naturally reproducing? Or are we okay with sort of a, you know, modernized man-made alternative to, what we had in the past?
Or do you just want to eat those farm fish from New Zealand?
And... Right, right. But no, I think that's a really good question. How do you talk about that? I think the simplest is to, you know, to get everybody on the same page. Sadly, it all comes down to economics, but, you know, I think that is one way that you have to, and I know that that's how a lot of people are talking about the Lower Snake River dams right now, is if we're, you know, putting in more money to keep these going than what we're getting out of them, you know, how is this making economic sense? So we have to talk about it in that way. And although the infrastructure we've built up so far, you know, benefits us in a number of ways economically, what is a better renewable resource than salmon coming back that we can, you know, maybe years down the road start to harvest again and actually, you know, live off of? So yeah, that's, I think, is one way to think about it, is in terms of economics and how, what an amazing resource they are and could be if we really gave them a chance.
Well, it's not that far. Well, it's just on the other side of the Dalles from Hood River. Mm-hmm. There are these amazing Indian scaffolds where they still fish for salmon. They still catch salmon there. But I'm sure you're familiar with those photographs of the Salado Falls.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the difference between what the indigenous people now are able to do on the same scaffolds that used to stand just before this amazing falls, which was one of the richest places to catch salmon in the world.
And you'll see the scaffolds, you know, at Cascade Locks too. You know, if you're going across the bridge, they're pretty easy to see there as well. There's, I'm trying to think if there's 80 in loo sites along that the Corps was required.
And what does an in-lieu site mean?
Oh, good question. Yeah. So in the treaties of Washington and Oregon with the tribes, I think 1855, 1857, I'm close there, one or the other, was their right to hunt and fish in their usual and accustomed places. That was part of the treaty. And in particular, when Bonneville went in, which was one of the first dams in 1937, they were promised 400 acres to make up for what they were losing, which was going to be flooded. Their usual fishing places were going to be flooded by that. So they were to get, yes.
Actually, this is a conversation I was having with Michael Peterson, maker of Dam to Extinction, last week. Let's talk about what's flooded, because I think people know about the Salado Falls. People don't know about the Cascade. So what was flooded when Bonneville Dam went in?
You know, I don't know that I can answer that
very
well.
It was an amazing, amazing whitewater run. It was called the Cascades. And in fact, probably more productive fishery even than Salado Falls.
Hmm.
So that's one of the things that Michael and Stephen really emphasize in their film. The things that we've lost for these dams, these incredible fisheries.
I saw one time, I'll go back to your question, but in doing that, the people at Salado Village, you know, of course, the loss of Salado Falls, I mean, is just an emotional one. I mean, for the native peoples, as well as, I mean, it hurts the heart. And so the thing was, when they were building the Dalles Dam, there was, you know, they were blowing things up. I will go back to the in-lieu, but so there was compounded the sadness, the fact that those falls were blown up as well. And so I think it was Colonel Miles was head of the region for the Corps of Engineers at that time. And so he had a LIDAR thing flown of that to show that the falls are still there, so that they were not blown up. And that was helpful at any rate. So going back to the in-lieu, was that these 400 acres that they were to provide, and then 80 years went past and nothing happened. And, you know, there were, after that, the Dalles Dam, McNary Dam, John Day Dam, you know, on and on, were built after that time, and yet those 400 acres were not put aside. And so in the late, I think it must have been in the late 1980s, maybe, or early 1990s, the tribes, Anton Minthorn told me one time that he felt like when they got the casinos, they started being able to have enough money that they could have some clout to go to these political places and say, you know, here's what we need. And so they started pushing for that, you know, is that these 400 acres have not been done. And so then the Corps was obligated to get to work on those. And so they started putting in sites up and down the Columbia to make up for those lost fishing sites. And those are called in-lieu sites. And they're just for the Native American population.
Well, actually, I went to the dedication of the one that's at Salilo Falls, and I think it was around 2000.
Yeah, right.
2000. It was a long time. And that was the first one. And I remember this kind of pivotal moment there. This guy, Colonel Strock, who was the Army Corps of Engineers general for, yes, General Strock, that he was like the Brigadier General for the Army Corps at that time. And so he was speaking, and in the middle of his speech, one of those many trains went by, and the railroad tracks are like 100 feet from the in-lieu site, and completely drowned him out. And I was recording the whole thing. I got the most incredible train recording from that moment. And so he was probably quieted for several minutes, and finally, when the train had passed, he says, "I apologize for the noise that the white man has brought to this valley."
Oh, very.
Then he went off to Iran, to Iraq, rather, and wreaked havoc there. But it was interesting to see even somebody like that who understood what the changes, not for the better, that white people had brought to this region. It's also an indication of just, and then that, I mean, they've built a lot more since. So you said there's 80 in loose sites now up and down the Columbia?
That's a thing off the top of my head. I'd have to look it up. But I'd be happy to send that to you, Barbara, because I don't remember exactly. But they're up and down the gorge now.
So are you able to incorporate that? I don't remember on your website if you have a specific section about indigenous people. I mean, or do you think they just sort of threads through every issue that you have?
It does through a lot, and it's great what you're, you know, connected to what we're talking about right now is a recent event that I was at, I guess it was 6 weeks ago or so now, but the Yakima and Lummi tribes meeting at Celilo Falls and, you know, asking the government to take out Bonneville, Dalles, and John Day Dams. So
wasn't just asking.
What's that?
they weren't just
exactly,
asking.
Exactly, you know, demanding. So, and I think there's going to be a lot to come from that, but in the bigger picture, you know, I think that goes to a lot what you're talking about with the train and, you know, what the white man has brought to this valley. And maybe there is, I'd like to think there is a bigger change in consciousness at work in how we view these rivers. And, you know, now that we have some time to, you know, hindsight's 2020, right? We can look back and see what we've done. We can look what we have and what we still have left to protect and save. And so I'd like to think that as, you know, films like Dam to Extinction are being made and people are thinking about the four lower Snake River dams coming out as the tribes are really calling attention and making, you know, reasonable arguments for why these should be taken out. I think that is something to be optimistic about in and of itself. The fact that we're having these conversations, that these demands are being made, that, you know, people are hearing this, whether or not it's the right people in charge that are, you know, moving those gears, but the fact that it's being talked about and we're trying to add our voice to that mix and you kind of reinforce that. So I think it's a pretty exciting time to be living close to the Columbia River. And you know, I know that you talked about it with Stephen Hawley and Michael, but the White Salmon River, I mean, that was only 8 years ago that we saw that. So we are.
And what was it that we saw?
Sorry, excuse me. Yeah, the Conda Dan coming out in 2011. So we are in such a cool time and place where we live right now to, you know, see the White Salmon start to come back. This morning, as I was coming to meet Susan Hood River, I was driving down the White Salmon River from my house, and I saw, you know, seven or eight bald eagles feeding on what was probably a dozen dead salmon washed up on this sandbar. And, you know, that's just kind of a little glimpse of maybe what it used to be or what it could be, but it's really exciting to see that. And I think every year we can watch that river and see what happens, and that will strengthen our argument for, you know, we realistically take mm-hmm. these dams out. These places are resilient. These species are incredibly resilient. And we just need to realize what we have and give them more of a chance, I think.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today with Susan Hess and Dak Collins, who are publisher and managing editor of the online journal Columbia Insight, which I like you said that you're fair and balanced. I always think of Fox News. But how do you distinguish yourself from Fox News in terms of being fair and balanced?
I think we just try to hold to that, you know, that we try to make sure that our articles are well-researched, that, you know, we have several eyes looking at that to make sure that it's researched. We try to make sure there's a very contentious issue in Hood River. You know, we try not to be, it's not just Hood River centric. I mean, we are trying to cover as much of the basin as we can, but we did cover this one article about Morton Park. It was very controversial, and I won't go into all the details of it, but whether it could be developed or was to be left as a park. And the community was hugely divided on it. And so one of our freelance writers wrote a piece about that, and they interviewed both sides. And so that article included both sides of the people who felt one way that we need affordable housing, the other piece, no, we need open space for parks. So they took the time to make sure that every one of those got on. I think one of the ones that Dak did was on a proposal to mine to the east side of Mount St. Helens. There's a mining proposal to go in there, and Dak did a story about that, and of course interviewed the people who are very much opposed to that. But he also let the mining company, you know, have their say about how they plan to do it and how they felt they could do it, you know, environmentally. And so it's, I think that's what we try to do. We try to be accurate. We try to make sure that that where there are different sides of an issue, that we give that voice. I guess, do you want to talk about that one about the H.W. Hill?
Yeah, actually just going to bring that up. Yeah. So this is something that I haven't noticed Fox News doing. Maybe they have. But, you know, we did a story, a couple of them actually, on this landfill gas plant at the Roosevelt landfill in Washington. And if you don't know about it, you should, because it's where your trash is going.
Yeah, tell us about it. Actually, this is why you're here, is to tell us about things we don't know about that are happening only 60, 70 miles from Portland.
Yeah, so this is a facility in eastern Klickitat County. So, you know, even from, if you have an idea of where White Salmon and Hood River are, you know, another hour plus east of that. So, and this is a regional landfill that takes most of Western Washington's garbage, a lot of Portland's garbage, even up to Vancouver and British Columbia, you know, both Vancouver.
And Alaska, from the North Shore of Alaska. Yeah.
I've even heard, you know, Guam's trash.
So actually, this trash is barged down the river?
Is on trains.
And on trains, okay.
I heard a stat, what was it last week? I think it's like every day it's
two mile long trains
every day come to this landfill. So you just try to wrap your head around that amount of garbage. And what they're doing right now is they've found a way to trap the methane that would otherwise be released, which, you know, as you know, is a really potent greenhouse gas, much more potent than carbon dioxide. So methane is a naturally released, you know, when garbage is rotting underground. And traditionally, that would just be burned off by most landfills with a big candle flare, and they would just burn that off, which is, you know, it's better to burn it off as carbon dioxide than methane. What they're actually doing here is taking it and converting it to usable natural gas that is, for the moment, being, compressed natural gas.
This is the renewable natural gas?
RNG. Yeah.
Right, which actually, I think we talked about this when we were having coffee a couple months ago. But
yeah.
This is actually, from what I've been understanding, is not bad stuff. Is that true?
I really don't think it is. The more that I looked into it, and you're really getting at where I'm going here, because to a lot of people, they see renewable natural gas, and they say, well, that's not actually renewable because we're having to generate waste to produce it. So that's sort of where this went. We you know, there's actually some of our more popular stories was on this H.W. Hill facility. And we had somebody reach out and to Susan, I think, actually, and send her a pretty long email saying, you know, I really don't think that you are covering the whole picture here. I don't think this is really such a big thing to celebrate. I think that there's, you know, some negative sides of this. So we said, would you like to write an op-ed? And he did. And, you know, it's we titled it Another Perspective on Landfill Gas. So, yeah, we're open to hearing the other side. I realize that when we're trying to figure out ways to move forward with in the middle of the climate crisis we're experiencing, you know, maybe there's no silver bullet answer, but it's interesting to hear other people, you know, that want to say, well, maybe this isn't something so we're celebrating. We'll let them say their piece. You know, that's part of what we do.
Well, I actually want to talk a bit more about this because I've learned about this from you guys. And since then, it's come up in a lot of conversations I've had with people who are fighting frack gas, whether it's Jordan Cove in Southern Oregon or the people in Washington who are fighting the LNG and methanol refinery proposals in Washington. And I'm getting a sense from most of the activists that they think that renewable natural gas, natural is a bad word, but anyway, renewable gas is actually a good thing. I mean, I hear the argument, well, it's just maybe encouraging us to produce more garbage, but even if it doesn't have to do that, I mean, we have to do something with our garbage.
Right.
Of course, we should be making less garbage, and that should be another thing, but I sort of see it in some ways is perhaps a little bit better for the planet than the dams.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
We sort of love this story because, you know, it is taking something that would just be rotting underground. You know, of course, the end aim is, you know, that we all use less, but and sort of creating stuff so there doesn't have to be fracking, so there doesn't have to be more drilling, that we're using something. And we're just kind of unique on that. So that's one. That's the biggest one. In fact, they made electricity before they switched to making natural gas out of it, and you could do the same thing. But then across the river, there's another one near Arlington, and that also...
That's where Portland's garbage mostly goes to.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And Seattle, the city of Seattle goes there as well. So they have a plant that makes electricity off of the garbage. There's one, Vancouver's garbage actually goes out to Finley Buttes, which is kind of Pendleton area, roughly.
And that's barged, right?
And that's barged,
yeah,
right.
I rode that barge one time.
Right. Yeah. And they make, so Finley Buttes makes electricity off of their garbage. Three Mile Canyon Farms, which of course has been very controversial near Boardman, but they, off of the cow manure, they use that to make electricity. So, you know, there's a lot of things we can plus and minuses, but it's an interesting attempt to use something that we can reuse for something that we need already.
Actually, I want to talk about Three Mile Canyon Dairy because that's another big gorge concern. Mm-hmm. And I didn't check to see, in your agriculture section, do you actually deal with that dairy, or are you looking only? I know you celebrate small local farms, but that dairy is kind of like the elephant in the middle of the river for this region.
It's very. We've only done one story on that, but it's very odd in some ways. I've never been to a farm that every entrance to it is gated, and there's a sentry. I don't know what the word sentry means exactly, but there's a staff person, and you can't just go on to the farm. And so, I did say.
Did they let you on? Did you?
They did. I took about 6 months of saying I just wanted to do a story about anaerobic digesters, which is this making dairy manure into electricity. And so they agreed that I could come on and do that. But of course, it's, you know.
But you couldn't come on and look at their animal practices or look at how much pollution they're creating or anything like that. They wouldn't let you do that, right?
No, I don't think so. I don't know how you get on. You know, it's like it's all fenced. I don't know. There's like 40,000. It's also
confined animal feed operation west of the Mississippi, I understand. I mean, it's...
I know, what did I... 80,000? I shouldn't be throwing numbers around.
And we can throw... Then there's the Lost Valley one, I think, that died.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, but this is a concern.
That's right. Dak wrote about that one.
So I mean, this is one of the things that's kind of happening in the gorge, but I think people in Portland are not real aware because it's gone the other side. It's on the east side of the gorge, and who goes out there anyway, except for our garbage.
Right.
But that, I mean, that's a place I'm very concerned about, because when I learned about when I first learned about Three Mile Canyon, and I learned what it really was, it was kind of an eye-opener, because I had been by CAFOs down in Southern California, and I felt like I was going past an animal concentration camp, and I thought, oh, we don't have these in Oregon. Then I found, oh, the one in Oregon's like way bigger.
Way bigger, yeah.
So I wonder how that impacts people's consciousness in Hood River and ways that you would cover that story, especially since they won't let you on.
Right, that's a good question. I think that goes to, taking it to the bigger picture, I think there's momentum for people to eat less beef. You know, I think that we don't.
But
it's
a dairy farm, actually.
Oh, that's right.
That's Tillamook cheese comes
from. I should say dairy products. Eat less dairy products.
Right. Yeah. See, these are the things that just kind of like talk about greenwashing. Tillamook dairy, you know, which beloved Tillamook dairy. And I think every time I think Tillamook dairy, I think about those cows grazing as you drive into Tillamook along Highway 6. And yes, I do understand. I think that's where our Tillamook cheese comes from. But if anything that goes out of state is coming from Three Mile Canyon.
It's a huge factory that they have there in Boardman. The other interesting thing that I found about Three Mile Canyon Farms that, you know, it's right next to the Boardman PG's power plant, you know, coal fired power plant is there. And then Boeing has a radar site that they test out there. It's a fascinating little, because I'm just always one, I think I can write a book about just that one little confluence. But Three Mile Canyon Farms got sued by a consortium of river watchdogs for some practices. And I don't know whether Three Mile Canyon Farms was declared, you know, guilty or not. I'm not sure what the outcome of that. But they did have to mitigate. There was an outcome they had to mitigate. And in response to that, they gave, I think it was 6,000 acres to the Nature Conservancy of land. And they actually have to pay them X amount per, and I think it was a 10-year lease. I'm sorry, I'm throwing these a little bit inaccurate sort of things, but close to that. It was a significant amount of acreage for a certain amount of time.
Right, so who's paying? Three Mile Canyon was paying.
Has to pay the Nature Conservancy.
To take care of the land, basically.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful piece of land. The manager there was saying it's like it's an island in a sea of agriculture.
Is it actually open to the public?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I think the Nature Conservancy has just transferred it to another also nonprofit natural resource group. But it is open, but you kind of need to know where it is. It's not easy to find. It's right behind the Boardman coal fire plant.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's the Cardi gas fire plant is also in that area, isn't it?
I don't know about that one.
Yeah, this is another PGE thing where they have a gas fire plant, which is replacing Boardman. Despite the fact that they might want you to think it's all going to be windmills that generate our power after 2020.
Right.
But, and then they were trying to build a second plant, and I'm not sure where it's all going. And now there's another, okay, let's move. Well, we have to, before we do that, I just want to let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking with Susan Hess and Dak Collins, who are with an online journal, an environmental journal and community journal called Columbia Insight. There's this, now it's something Windcatcher. There's a gas fired plant that is trying, and it's just gotten its first permits from the state of Oregon. And it's out there again in the Boardman area. I'm wondering if you've heard about that one.
I've not. So, yeah.
Okay, check it out. I'll find out the name of it, and I'll send you the name of it. And I'll probably be doing some more shows on it because it's another great. Some of the ultimate greenwashing when you name a gas-fired plant something Windcatcher.
Right.
So, but there's a lot of energy issues that are certainly, there's because of where Hood River's located for sure, and sort of in the center of this incredible array of climates and geologies and other components that make for great sources of energy. How does that affect your region, and how do you cover that so that you can really give your readers a sense of like what's facing them? Because it's the other part of you're talking, Dak, about, you know, we're moving into this great future. We are, by the way, I've learned from the tribes, we're in the seventh generation, which means they're at the seventh generation from when they signed those treaties. And what they believe about the seventh generation is that this is the time we make it or break it. And I mean, you can feel it. I mean, because the tribe is because of having a little more financial resources than they had 30, 40 years ago, and yet they've really organized it. I mean, they are in the forefront of fighting against fossil fuel and all these other atrocities that are being perpetrated on the landscape. But I was told by Taylor Tupper, who's with the Klamath tribes in Southern Oregon, that it's not just the indigenous youth that are, you know, on the forefront, it's all youth. And she said that about six, it was right after the first climate strike. So we can see that, you know, the young people are really engaged, and this is a time where we can move things forward. So rather than the other vision, which could be that it's the end of the life as we know it, taking that energy, I mean, how do you deal with it both, you know, literally in terms of it, you know, looking at how we are getting energy to power our lives, but also the energy of people and consciousness to stand up against some of the other bad ways that we energize our societies?
Yeah, I think one thing is giving credit to how, you know, our human ingenuity and thinking that if we really do sort of find ways to work together to come up with common solutions that we can do that. I'm thinking just in terms of hydropower. I know that we've put so much faith in these huge, you know, giant hydro projects. Whereas if you look in other parts of the world, I think there's a lot being done with smaller scale hydro, whether it's in-stream turbines or smaller dams that don't impede fish passage so much, or don't make such a marked shift on the landscape. So I think a lot of that is allowing innovation to happen, is allowing us to think about, you know, we've been doing this for 100 years. It doesn't mean that there's not a much better way to do it. And I think, as we find ways to store our energy better, that's a lot what you hear people talking about, is that storage is what we're really lacking, right? We can generate a lot of wind and solar power, but it's how we store it that's going to be that we're really struggling with right now. So I think once we, you know, move those innovations forward and try to make that a priority, I think it can certainly happen.
So actually, the storage, we're getting where the storage, this is one of the things that both Stephen and Michael were saying very strongly last week, in terms of why we can decommission a lot more dams than they're thinking about, including the three that the tribes are talking about now. Mm-hmm. But that storage is probably there. But then the question is, how do you recycle those batteries? That's the next step. And it's like, and that's where I think, you know, in the seventh generation mindset, I mean, how do we get white people to start thinking seventh generations ahead? Because it's all well and great if we have all these wonderful lithium-ion batteries, though if it means overthrowing the government in Bolivia to get the lithium, that's a questionable thing. And it also, the way that I was hearing that the way that they manufacture them makes it really, really hard to take them apart when they need to be disposed of or recycled. So I was just wondering, because I just see the Hood River as being in this real kind of, the wind's blowing, it's just this pivotal place in the world. How do you start to generate the kind of energy that can envision, maybe just start envisioning seven generations ahead and learning from indigenous people how to get white people to think the same way?
And really, that's what drives me a lot with publishing this, is, you know, providing, I think, my sense is that as we're more urbanized as a people, that we lose that sort of understanding of how nature works. So one of the things for that's driven us a lot is conservation rather than alternative energy, because we'll never catch up. You know, they talk about it, you know, in the 1950s, the average house size was 800 square feet and the family size was, you know, six. And now the average house size is almost 2,500 and the average family is like 2.1. So we're never going to catch up if we don't sort of start doing conservation. You know, like the wind, I think I worry about people not understanding wind power, is that, you know, those footings are concrete and they're anywhere from 25 to 60 feet wide and they go down that deep. And this is marching across agricultural land. It's a marching cat wildlife habitat. So it's not, you know, you mentioned the problem with lithium batteries. You know, these are not, just because they're alternative doesn't mean they're free from any sort of environmental harm. So that's sort of our message. We've done things about tiny houses. We've done things about explaining the grid. We're doing this about the HW Hill. We're kind of talking about energy to think about all those connections that these things make.
What kind of response have you been getting Do you feel like you're really reaching out, first of all, just to your own local region and then to the rest of the basin?
I think it's been good. You know, we definitely have most of our readership still in Hood River, and we are right now mostly reader supported. So we've seen that grow. We've seen our subscribers grow in the last year or so.
So it's people do a paid subscription to
it? No, oh. it's totally. It's, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, okay. It's anybody can subscribe. It's free. We really, part of the reason that we went and Susan really had this idea to go with a nonprofit model was because, you know, of the belief that it should be free for the public, you know.
So how do you support yourself?
Reader donations, you know, sort of.
So kind of like KBOO.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anybody can listen to KBOO, but we love the people who actually give us money. So.
Exactly. And I think one way that, you know, one, obviously seeing some donations come in is great, but also just the amount of responses and emails and comments we get and people, like I said, who want to disagree with us and share their perspective. I mean, I think that shows that we are indeed reaching the community and that there are, you know, we're making people think about these things and in turn, they're making us think even deeper about them.
And it's more than just written word, right? Or written, the digital word. I mean, it looks like you have a podcast and other resources.
Yeah, we just started diving into that the last 4 or 5 months. Our most recent podcast actually ties back into salmon we were talking about earlier. It's about attempts to bring salmon back to the upper Columbia. So that would be above Chief Joe and Grand Coulee, which would require a lot of contraptions, let's say.
Very tall fish ladders.
Exactly.
Actually, well, let's talk a little bit about that and then we'll go back into what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking about it. This is one of the concerns because taking out the four lower Snake River dams is pretty easy. I mean, I guess I learned from those guys that they're like one half or one third earthen. So you just take out the earth. And so it's not a major demolishing thing.
Yeah.
But I know when they put in the Grand Coulee Dam, which completely plugged up the river from, you know, half the river.
Yeah.
Up in Canada, no, the fish couldn't run anymore. Their justification for not putting any fish ladders there was there weren't any at Chief Joseph, which is the first dam.
Right.
The river. What are you going to do? I mean, Priest Rapids, I think, doesn't have fish ladders either. I'm not positive about that. But
I'm not positive. The way that I was talking to, you know, the Upper Columbia United Tribes and some of the tribes themselves, so that's, you know, the Colville and that's Perce, a lot of those in that region, northeast and kind of central Washington. And for the way I understand it, I think it's really Chief Joe and Grand Coulee that are totally blocking fish passages. And, you know, fish haven't been up there in hundreds.
It's about not quite 90 years.
90 years, yeah. So they did a ceremonial release this year, and that was in, you know, in a lot of the news, and I think was really exciting.
What do you mean by a ceremonial release?
A ceremonial release was the tribes actually releasing Chinook into Lake Roosevelt. So I think they put in, you know, I think a couple dozen fish there, and it was, again, I think it's, you know, just a testament to a bigger change occurring of, you know, and as far as how we are, managing our rivers, but
so Lake Roosevelt is above the Grand Coulee Dam.
Yes.
So so that means that those fish could then swim up to the source of the Columbia River.
Yeah.
Well, there's four dams. There's four dams, and
before they get to the golf course. Yeah.
There's four dams in British Columbia too, and they're pretty high dams too.
Yeah, and that, not to get too all over the place, but that's another big thing that we're covering a lot is the Columbia River Treaty and that ongoing, and whether or not ecosystem based function will be considered going forward, how they manage those four dams. So that, you know, actually connects a lot to the efforts to reintroduce salmon, because that in part has galvanized these people, you know, a lot of the tribes and a lot of the fish biologists to say, you know, if we're going to start thinking about how to manage for the ecosystem as well as barges and farmers and, you know, residents and flood control and all that, well, then let's at least find ways to get fish up there. So without giving, you know, I encourage listeners to check out our podcast, but a big part of it would be the Whoosh Passage Portal, which has also been called the Salmon Cannon. Very exciting sounding. But yeah, that's...
What's that?
So it's essentially a giant pneumatic tube. If you think of the tubes they had at the bank, I don't think they still have them anymore. But thinking about putting a fish in there, it's a lot more complex than that. But, you know, it's exciting that people are coming with these ideas. They did. They had a permit, I think, to at least test it out and got some Chinook in the system that way. So it's exciting. And it's also, it goes back to earlier what I was saying is, you know, are we okay with living with these man-made rivers? I mean, if we're not going to taking out the lower three Columbia River dams and the lower Snake River dams is one thing, taking out Grand Coulee is a whole another can of worms. So are we okay with having these sort of artificially propagated runs if we can get fish up towards Canada? I mean, you know, again, it's I think something to be excited about and something we're definitely going to be paying attention to.
Well, I think I want to encourage Portland listeners and people who, wherever you are in the world now listening to KABU here, to check out your website, which is columbiainsight.org.
Yep.
And to learn more about the perspective of the world from the eyes of people who are living right at the heart of the Columbia River. I just want to thank you for joining us today. I think your endeavor is really exciting. And besides reading your great articles, there's also links to everybody in the world.
So, yeah, in fact, Locus Focus. You can find Locus Focus on our media webpage.
So if you can't find it here at KABU, you can go to columbiainsight.org and check it out.
Barbara, it's been a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and thanks, Zach.
Yeah, thanks for the work you do.
And we'll
keep
in touch, and I feel like we're kind of sister organizations here.
Definitely.
So I've been talking today with Susan Hess and Dak Collins, publisher and managing editor of the online journal Columbia Insight, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KABU Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KABU Public Affairs programming, go to kabu.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be talking with Tony Juniper, who's author of Rainforest, Dispatches from the Earth's Most Vital Frontlines. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with a tune I read about the Columbia River. Thanks for listening. Thank you.